north of Los Angeles. It's in an area where some of the country's largest wind farms are already operating around the clock. Now, the sticking point in this project's approval is that the company would not face criminal charges if a California condor is hit by a wind turbine blade. But federal officials say they're requiring the company to install electronic sensors that would detect when a bird is near, and a biologist will monitor the operation. Environmental groups like the American Bird Conservancy say the project's approval, though, signals a dangerous precedent. There are only 250 California condors currently in the wild, and the group says allowing a company to evade prosecution if one of the birds is killed will threaten their recovery. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
And I'm Paul Brown. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Lincoln Financial Group. For over 100 years, working to help Americans take charge of their futures and become their own chief life officers.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons at 1 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, with beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, and for those with or recovering from cancer. New classes start the first week of June. Details at yoga-cu.com.
This is an encore edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Life in the U.S. military is regimented, organized from the moment you arrive to start basic training to the end of service. You learn quickly where you're supposed to go and what you're supposed to do in a carefully structured hierarchy. Changes within that culture can lead to challenges both within and outside military ranks. Policy changes, like the Obama administration's move earlier this year to open more military positions, including ground combat missions, to women, are prompting cultural change within the military, something everyone within it must adjust to. But there's another change that people in military service make once they return to civilian life. The rules are different, from speed limits to family dynamics, who you talk to about what and when. For those who enlist in the armed forces right out of high school in particular, returning to civilian life can be a challenge. This hour on Focus, we'll listen back to a conversation that Craig Cohen had in January of this year, exploring the idea of change in the military. Later in the hour, we'll hear from a veteran Navy corpsman who is now a student at the University of Illinois about her adjustment from military to civilian life. We'll also hear from someone with the university's Veterans Student Support Service on how they try to help veterans make the adjustment. But first, we delve into the changing roles for women in the U.S. military. It was in January, just a week after this encore broadcast first aired, that Defense Secretary Leon Panetta announced a policy shift that opened frontline positions to women. Now, women in the U.S. Armed Forces have been seeing combat for a decade, but they haven't been able to do so on a large scale. To discuss this shift, its implications for the military, and the experience of military service for women today, Craig Cohen talked with Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs Executive Director Erica Borgren.
Erica Borgren, welcome to Focus.
Thanks for having me.
What was your immediate reaction to the announcement last week?
You know, I suppose I have two immediate reactions. I really saw that announcement through two lenses. One, sitting in the position that I am at the helm of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs, I hear an announcement like that, and I think it's a call to all of us to be very aware that there are changing demographics in our military, but as a result of that, in our veteran community. Women veterans are the fastest-growing population inside the veteran community, and I think it's a call to all of us to be aware that we'll need to support these women more in the years to come.
And you were saying you had sort of two reactions?
That's right. The second lens I hear through is a personal one. Having been an Army officer myself, I heard that through the lens of my own experience and really found it to be a very exciting and encouraging movement. It's clearly not out of the blue. It's, I think, the next step in a process that has been happening just due to the fact that women have been serving in increasingly in combat situations in the course of the last decade, and the Army and other services have recognized that. And so I think it's a natural next step that's encouraging to those of us who have served in uniform.
Was there a part of you that essentially said, well, it's about time?
I'm not sure it was that frank a reaction. I think once you're inside the military world, you do recognize that there are barriers. It's not as simple as you make an announcement and the next day this is going to happen. And so I think that having been in uniform and experienced what, or at least seen some of those changes that will need to happen from a cultural perspective inside the infantry and other aspects of the military world that previously haven't been open, you do understand. But I am glad to see the continued motion, the movement, I guess, toward recognizing that men and women together have been making great and vital contributions to our national security, and why not let them do that in these roles as well.
So what does this movement suggest about how the U.S. military may begin to operate differently than it has in the past?
I actually think it will be a move toward even higher standards. This is something that our military is known for. It's a wonderfully merit-based system of rising through the ranks. And I think that this move reinforces that and is just the next move in that. Because what the announcement is a direction from the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense for the services to take a look at positions that have previously been closed in branches of service that have previously been closed and say, okay, don't just say, are you man or woman, do you qualify? Say, what is the actual physical standard that's required, and mental standards as well, to meet the exact needs of this career field. And so, you know, there are men who can't meet the standards of the infantry career field or of that branch. And what this will do is define very clearly what those standards are, so men and women, the best, have to meet them.
Might this move lead also to perhaps an increase in the number of people enlisted in the armed forces, period?
I'm not sure that it would have that impact. I think that there are a very small number of women inside those who already serve in the military who will be drawn to serve in these kinds of branches that will now be open. I think the initial pool of women that they'll enter these fields as they open are probably from within the ranks themselves. And they're going to need to be some fantastic women, some women that are kind of ready to break the barriers as women of decades past have done.
Do you think this is important in particular when you consider the number of multiple deployments for troops after a decade of wars on two fronts?
The announcement itself, you mean?
The announcement itself and the idea that it might lead to more people specifically enlisted in ground troop warfare that maybe weren't before. All of a sudden, instead of cycling through the same soldiers, you've got some new blood, if you will, in every aspect
possibly,
of the armed forces.
Possibly. I mean, clearly women have been deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere throughout the world in support of these operations for the last decade. So I'm not sure if it would be new blood so much as women serving in different capacities on their next deployment.
The perception, rightly or wrongly, among some, is that the U.S. military has been at times and perhaps continues to be a bit of an old boys club. You served in the Army as a senior staff member under General Petraeus in Iraq. Could you describe your experience as a woman in the U.S. military? How were you treated?
Sure. I'm not sure I'd have used the phrase old boys club, but I think that phrase that you sometimes do hear as a descriptor gets at something I did experience as a woman in uniform, which is just that it's a very masculine culture, and that's the nature of a career field where the percentages are as they are. And so I think, you know, every woman has their own journey to walk in terms of finding your authentic leadership style in the military world where you find your authentic voice and yet can, you know, stand in front of the formation and when need be, summon your inner Patton. You know, men have to walk that journey as well, but I think for women it sometimes has to be a more deliberate and is perhaps a lengthier journey, and that certainly was my experience.
Have you actually, as those moments have come up in your career, thought of it as, I need to bring out my inner Patton?
I actually have.
Yeah.
That is how I thought of it. You know, I discovered in my first, I'd say 3 or so years of service, that you could be a really very effective Army officer just by virtue of caring a lot about what you do and the people you lead and by having some management competence. But several years into my initial career, I became a company commander, which is a position where you're standing in front of 150 or so soldiers, and, you know, gosh darn it, you ought to have the bearing to go with that. And so I did have to make a transition there where I had to augment what I consider to be my natural leadership strengths of making people want to come alongside you with the ability to have that bodily stillness and the demeanor of authority in front of a formation and in a uniform code of military justice hearing, you name it. And I absolutely thought of it as summoning my inner Patton. And interestingly, by the end of company command, I felt much more comfortable with it, the fact that that was an authentic piece of my leadership style by the end. And I've used it in my civilian career ever since.
Well, in what ways have you used it in your civilian career?
Well, I've been used to being one of few, if not the only, women in a room of folks making decisions and making things happen just by virtue of being in uniform. Lots of women in uniform have had that experience. And so I default to my natural leadership style, making people want to help you and come along alongside you. But when I need to have the authority that sometimes a position requires, I'm comfortable wielding that. And I think that's a journey everyone discovers in their military experience, and it's what makes military leaders, officers, NCOs, non-commissioned officers, it's what makes you effective in the civilian world as well, partially, is that experience of having had to, you know, step into unknown waters and, you know, you're in charge. You've got to figure this out and lead this unit toward a mission. And I've used that immensely at the helm of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs, certainly.
How would you say your military experience would compare to the military experience of women who came before you?
I would say the women that came before this most recent generation of women in the military broke barriers that have changed the culture. I talk about, you know, a masculine culture. It's nothing, I would think, compared to what the women who came in generations before us did. I think specifically of the class of 1980, the first class at West Point that had women in it. And I actually ran across, when I was a cadet at West Point, and traveling, I think, for a tennis tournament, ran across a woman who was from the class of 1980, and she recognized that I was from West Point as I was traveling with the tennis team. And she actually broke down crying when she encountered us as a tennis team because she could not believe how much we seemed like normal women, that we had earrings in and that we were feminine and you name it. And she, that was not her experience, the ability to be herself like that when she was at West Point. And so I think women that came before us, they made it so that it is navigable today as a woman in the military.
Have you thought about whether you owe a certain responsibility to that previous generation in terms of how you commend yourself during the time in the armed forces and now with the Department of Veterans Affairs?
I would say that as a person who serves in uniform, you feel the fact that you're standing on the shoulders of soldiers and who have come in generations before you. You feel that in general across history. It's just something about having the uniform on and having that flag of the United States on your shoulder, on your uniform. Do I feel that particularly toward the women veteran community? I'm very aware that they broke barriers for us. And it certainly it's an aspect of my position and the lens that I naturally bring to the Department of Veterans Affairs that there are tens of thousands of women veterans here in Illinois, many of whom have had quite different experiences, but all of whom were sisters in arms, as it were. And we do owe it to search out these women and make sure that they have the services and support that they need. Because too often women veterans actually don't come out of the woodwork and take advantage of the veteran resource system in the same way that their male counterparts do.
As you noted earlier, women have been in combat for the last decade. That's not new, but maybe not on such a large scale as is being suggested now. And as the shift in policy makes it a more prevalent situation, we are once again hearing concerns from some corners, mostly political, but still, that women in combat, just like the argument against gays in the military or decades ago, the integration of the military, could impact unit cohesion. We hear that phrase thrown around. What's your response to those kinds of claims?
Morale and cohesion, that's long been the concern when it comes to any kind of integration. And I certainly think it's a real concern, which isn't to say we shouldn't find a way to address it. Only that, when it comes to, and I can speak mostly from the perspective of the Army, when it comes to the infantry world or the special forces world or these aspects of the services that have not been opened in the past, These are kind of the last bastions of the true kind of all-male culture in our military worlds. And so these are worlds where it hasn't been said to this point, hey, take down that poster, or you can't talk like that about women. The culture there is more strongly masculine. And so there's some culture change that needs to happen to allow this to move forward, and I think you'll be seeing that in the years to come. And I think that's what gets at the, sometimes when people speak of unit cohesion or the morale, it's, oh, well, we're going to have to change, and we can't act how we've acted. And it's really not that simple. We need leaders who are going to stand up and help make that cultural change, not allow the comments, not allow the you name it that makes the culture so unwelcoming to women.
Another argument espoused during the presidential campaign last year came from GOP hopeful Rick Santorum, who said he was concerned about scenarios in which a man's natural instinct to come to the aid of a woman could create a compromising situation. For those who have not been in combat or not been in the armed forces for that matter, could you clarify the mindset of soldiers in battle?
Well, I've heard that concern raised before as well, and I think you said it very well. But when it comes to comrades in arms fighting shoulder to shoulder in a battle, you are one unit. That's your battle buddy to your left and your right. And whether it's a man or a woman, you're fighting for the sake of that battle buddy on your left and your right. So I'm not sure that it's actually a concern that's anything more than what happens day to day with our men and women who are serving overseas right now. You are, of course, concerned for protecting the life of your battle buddy on your left and right in that foxhole.
We're talking with Erica Borgren, director of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. What do we civilians typically not know about the experience of military service for women today?
I'd actually say it's something that characterizes the women veteran community at large, and sadly, the community of women in uniform, too. And that is that there is a great prevalence of military sexual trauma. That's our very technical term for saying that a large percentage of women, between a fifth and a third or a half, some say, have experienced some kind of sexual assault or trauma during their time in uniform. And for too many women, that becomes, sadly, a defining part of their experience in uniform. And maybe back here in the veteran community, why a lot of women don't come out of the woodwork to access the many supports and services that are out there. There's been a lot of attention recently, frankly, on the services themselves and on the fact that this trend is there. And they've had some changes at the Department of Defense level lately. But I don't know that this is a trend that is yet public in a way that we're all now aware of post-traumatic stress. For a lot of women veterans, post-traumatic stress, which is simply a mental health reaction to a traumatic event you've experienced, is actually induced by some kind of sexual trauma, as much as it is by combat or whatever your experience was. And this is something I think we need more public light and awareness on.
What else would you like to see happen within the military ranks culturally to try and address that?
I think it is both cultural but also policy, and sometimes I think the culture changes by virtue of the policy changing. And so encouragingly, what we've seen inside the services recently is a change from the Secretary of Defense level after he saw a film entitled The Invisible War that documented some of the struggles of women who had endured sexual assault of some kind. You know, the story on the street is that he saw that film and was struck by the fact, as they highlight in the film, that the way that the military system convenes justice, so that the company commander is the one that becomes aware of a report of a sexual assault, and then it's up to him or her whether to convene some kind of investigation or court-martial into that. That's not probably the right level for that decision to be made, because it reflects poorly on you as a unit commander to say this happened in your ranks. And so they've made some changes from the policy perspective to elevate that decision-making authority outside of the company commander or battalion commander level, and hopefully make it safer for women to report and to change the culture there. Again, I think the culture follows on from the policy, and if we can make this such that you can report safely, then we stop repeat offenders, we stop it being a culture where you know, men can get away with this.
Do you think there needs to be more overt instruction or something within even the time, even basic training to address this? Or is there already some effort?
There already is. So this is, as much as it might be a new issue to the public, it's not a new issue to those in the services or even those of us in the veteran world. And there certainly is training, I want to say annual and mandatory, but at about every level you could find it on that.
Do you think the training that exists is enough, or do you think it needs to be addressed in a different way than it is now?
You know, we're getting into terrain where I have to say it's inside a military world that I've been separated from now for 5 years, and where there have been changes since I've separated. I see it now through the lens of somebody leading an organization that's trying to serve women veterans well. And so when I look at it from the veteran side, that for the rest of their lives, women will be, you know, dealing with whatever their military experiences were. And for the most part, they're very positive, and women come out with some great experiences in leadership and you name it. But for women who have struggled with this particular issue, I see it through the lens of how do we serve these women better? How do we make it safe to speak about this? How do we create safe spaces for women veterans to connect with each other and be able to talk about what happened? Because I'm not sure that that has existed in the past.
Let's talk a little bit about your role now as director of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. You're concerned with what happens when soldiers leave the service and return to civilian life, and that's something we're going to discuss in more detail in the second half of today's program. What are the greatest challenges that you believe soldiers face adjusting to civilian life?
It's interesting. I have a hard time separating a single challenge from others when it comes to what veterans are struggling with. I think of it actually in one word, and that is the transition. And for some veterans, a particular aspect of that transition is more difficult than another. There are several issues, I think, though, wrapped up inside that transition. And again, they're interrelated in an individual case, for sure. There's just simply coming home and being in an entirely different world where there are stoplights that work and traffic laws that you need to obey and choices on what you're going to purchase in the store day to day, where you're interacting with a family that you haven't interacted with and lived with over the last year. There's the unemployment challenge, the fact that a lot of veterans come back and simply can't find the work that would allow them to continue to pour their energies into something worthwhile. And, you know, that's also related to service members struggling with the experiences they've had, and whether they have post-traumatic stress disorder or simply are coping with their combat experiences, it creates some struggles in the transition. And all three of these, I think, feed each other.
Well, I also wonder, you know, we hear a lot in the media about PTSD and health services for veterans, but not so much about the day-to-day run-of-the-mill tasks that the rest of us learned when we were 18, that someone who maybe went straight into a career in the armed forces may not know about. How much of an adjustment is it to learn to pay your rent, to figure out where to go to buy certain things, to go to the dry cleaners, you know, whatever other tasks the rest of us might consider mundane and obvious?
I think for some more than others, those certainly become obstacles upon the return. I mean, a lot of service members enter right from high school at the, you know, young age of 17 or 18 and then come back and, as you say, haven't had to figure out rent or security deposits before. And so certainly there are organizations out there, I think of the USO or other financial literacy organizations that try and do outreach and find veterans and help them with these aspects of the transition. I don't know that they're the defining aspects of the transition, but particularly for young veterans who entered right out of high school and maybe never built that skill set, it is an aspect of the transition.
You mentioned that some veterans really struggle to find work. In some cases, I imagine those obstacles to finding a good job, they may have the skill sets, but maybe the private sector doesn't know they have the skill sets.
It's very mystifying, not only for the service member themselves, but certainly for the employer, to understand how it is that... Depending on the career field does have a great translation into the civilian world, but as you highlight, the services have not found the best ways so far of demystifying that for civilian employers. But I'm happy to say there's some good work going on that front now.
I do understand that, yeah, there are efforts to try and better articulate the specific skills, equipment, you know, what you name it, that a veteran has trained and learned through their experience in the armed forces, that maybe the military calls it one thing and the private sector calls it something else.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right. So when it comes to soft skills, it's mostly helping veterans individually translate the fact that they led or they managed logistics or something that everybody does in uniform. But when it comes to these harder technical skills that service members are trained on, there is a lot of effort underway. There's a presidential task force on veteran employment that's working with several partner states, and Illinois is one of them, to provide some of the more in-depth information of the training that happens in this case, the most dense military career fields, those that there are the most service members in, and seeing how we can to use the word I have already, demystify that and find the right terms, even approach the accrediting body that could take a look at these more detailed documents and say, yep, that actually gets you, you know, 8 out of 10 of the steps. And so once we can have that defined, some the relevant accrediting body, or here in Illinois, we've got a licensing task force going with our state agencies. Once you can define that gap, then schools can step up and identify and create bridge programs so that veterans aren't having to go from A to Z, but perhaps from M to Z, and so that employers can understand how close veterans really are when it comes to that training.
What are the major concerns that you hear from veterans about how they are treated or how the world perceives them in and out of the armed forces?
You could go a number of directions with that one, but I think a lot of times what you hear from service members has to do with what happens when somebody discovers that you served in uniform. And I've actually experienced this one personally, which is that somebody, you know, discovers you're a veteran, maybe you served in Baghdad as I did, and they say, thanks for your service. Crickets. It's a conversation stopper because nobody knows how to engage it. It's not a world they know, and I think as a result of that, it tends to be isolating when the civilian world, with the best of intentions and actually meaning that statement, thanks for your service, doesn't ask the follow-on questions because they're afraid to ask it wrongly. And so I encourage everywhere I go, I encourage citizens across the state to say thanks for your service and to even say that in tangible ways, but to say, ask the next question. So what was that like? Or where did you serve? How did you find your experience? Because the veteran themselves will shut that conversation off if it's not somewhere they want to go. But when supportive and grateful citizens shut the conversation off, it makes military experience very isolating.
What one or two things do you wish could be done to make the transition to civilian life easier for veterans?
I suppose it depends if you're asking from a personal level or the individual level or the systemic level.
Well, both, really.
I think there's a lot to be done on better handoff from the Department of Defense world to the federal VA, and certainly from the Department of Defense world to state veterans agencies. You know, we get approached as a State Department all the time about, you know, we want to hire veterans, we want to serve veterans, we want to send packages to veterans that are back. Where are they? And the assumption is that the state agency knows where all those veterans are. And while I do know where a lot of them are because they've reached out for our services, the sad reality is that a lot of veterans get lost when they come back. Because, you know, I got their separation document when they arrived back home in state, but if that's not their home of record anymore, I'm not going to be able to get in touch and try and reach out before the downward spiral happens. So I think the more dots we can connect inside the system in terms of confidential and respectful of privacy, but data sharing, so we can have a better idea and reach out better to our veterans, that's something that can really help us, again, stop the downward spiral for a lot of veterans before it even starts.
What about for you personally, when you left the armed forces? Granted, you have gone to work for the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs, so you're still closely aligned with and dealing with military veterans. But was there any one thing or a couple of things that you wish you knew when you left active duty?
Unfortunately, no silver bullet. But I will say I had an experience that seems resonate with others, which is that you leave this military world where the next step or the next move is always defined. You know what that next step is, or you receive your assignment orders from the Department of the Army and you know where you're headed. And when all of a sudden you come out of uniform and you have so much less direction, and not only that, you don't have the networks, it's almost like a black space, another world where you don't really know what the opportunities are. And I certainly that was my own personal experience, but I think a lot of veterans experience that you come back into a world that you don't know the networks, the roads, the people who can help introduce you to, as you might have known, in uniform. And so I think that for me, a mentorship proved important, an active networking proved important. If I had known that the State Department of Veterans Affairs was there and all that they can help connect you with in terms of resources and just learning the range of civilian jobs that are out there, I would have reached out and tried to take advantage of that. And so I think part of it is, how can we reach out better to these veterans as they come back?
I imagine it's tough going from such a structured, regimented world where from the moment you wake up to the moment you sleep, you're essentially told or you learn very quickly, this is where you go and this is what you do over the course of your day. And all of a sudden, now you're you know, sort of left to your own devices to a certain degree.
I think that that is particularly true for junior enlisted soldiers for whom it was their entire military experience to be in that capacity. And certainly you come back into this netherworld, as I've described it, and you do lack that direction and the defined time windows. On the other hand, I don't want to overly paint the veteran community as one which completely struggles and doesn't bring back great skill sets, because by the time most service members have been in for 3 or 4 years, they've all of a sudden got an NCO stripe on their shoulder and they're a non-commissioned officer who's in charge of something. And so now you're giving direction, you're learning how to meet a mission and how to get your team there. And so while there might be some transitional difficulties in terms of not knowing the options or the networks or the roads in this world, you certainly bring a skill set to it that can help you navigate it.
We began by talking about women in combat, and I kind of wonder if we shouldn't conclude with a simple question, whether or not the transition to civilian life, is there something specific that is challenging for female veterans specifically?
It's a good question, because we get this often, folks interested in helping women veterans, a lot of interest in women veterans lately, but nobody really seems to know, at least those individual organizations here and there, what it is that women veterans need. When you take a step back and look at the research and the trends, there really are three, let's call them complicating factors when it comes to women veterans and the transition. All the other typical veteran transition issues are there, but there are three complicating factors. One is that women veterans, as I've alluded to this point, don't self-identify, don't come out of the woodwork and take advantage of resources to the same extent. Women veterans are 30% less likely to access and use the VA health system as their male counterparts. And I think that's partially a result of the culture, and whatever aspect of the culture you were done dealing with, you simply were done with coping. And so a lot of women veterans don't want to be in the veteran world. Whatever the cause, though, there's the fact that if you're not able to take advantage of the resources that are out there, you very well might struggle through the transition more. A second complicating factor is the issue we've discussed, which is that so many women have struggled with some kind of military sexual trauma or sexual assault of some kind, and clearly that's a complicating factor in a transition, and one that needs to inform how we put our events together, how we reach out to women, et cetera. And then the third complicating factor is the fact that women veterans serve in some kind of primary caregiver status in greater numbers or percentages than their male counterparts, which is a beautiful thing, but it's also a complicating factor, because if you're a primary caregiver for a child or an aging parent, you actually can't make your VA appointments, or you can't be at the job fair or go to the 6-week job training program that's free for your male veteran counterparts. And that's really a code that we haven't cracked as the veteran community, how it is that we can create, child care opportunities where women veterans are able to take us up on all that's out there.
Erica Borgren is director of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. Director Borgren, thanks so much for talking with us. And forgive me, I have to say it. Thanks for your service.
Oh, thank you, Greg. I appreciate it.
I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore edition of Focus. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll listen back to a conversation my colleague Craig Cohen had with Elizabeth Ambrose, a veteran Navy corpsman who's now a student at the University of Illinois, about adjusting to life outside the military. And Nicholas Osborne, a Coast Guard veteran and assistant dean of services for veteran student support at the University of Illinois, about the resources available for veterans at the U of I. We'll be right back after this short break.
On the next Fresh Air, poet and soldier Brian Turner will read poems about his experiences in the Iraq War.
You will hear the RPG coming for you, not so the roadside bomb.
And Maureen Corrigan shares the story of discovering a 1945 letter from the Secretary of the Navy to her father after he'd retired from the Navy. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILO programming is made possible by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, announcing the 2013-2014 season featuring Elnora, the Guitar Festival, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Diavolo, Nathan and Julie Gunn and Friends, the Joshua Redman Quartet, and more. Tickets are on sale Saturday, August 10th at 10 a.m.
Welcome back to this encore edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and for this Memorial Day, we're listening back to a conversation my colleague Craig Cohen had earlier this year that explores the idea of change in the U.S. military. During this half of the show, we'll hear about life after military service and the challenges that are presented by that transition. Craig talks with two guests, Elizabeth Ambrose and Nicholas Osborne.
Elizabeth Ambrose is a 26-year-old veteran Navy corpsman who is now a student at the University of Illinois. Elizabeth Ambrose, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us. And Dr. Nicholas Osborne is Assistant Dean of Students for Veteran Student Support Services at the U of I, who is himself a veteran of the U.S. Coast Guard. Dr. Osborne, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Elizabeth, first of all, where did you serve in the Navy? For how long? Tell us a little bit about that initial experience.
Well, I first joined the Navy in 2004. I went through our preliminary training school, which was Corpsman A School. That was in Great Lakes, Illinois. Then I was first stationed in Memphis, Tennessee at just a base clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, I was then transferred to my second tour, which was with the Marine Corps as a Fleet Marine Force Corpsman. And I was out of South Carolina, Beaufort.
Okay. And then you ultimately served overseas.
I did. I deployed with the Marine Wing Sports Squadron 273 to Iraq in OIF 8.2.
Okay. And what did that entail? What did you do there?
Well, I was a corpsman, and a corpsman, for those who don't know, is basically medical support. And to be an FMF corpsman, a Fleet Marine Force corpsman, you are attached to a Marine Corps unit. So I went with my Marine Corps unit to Iraq, and I served as the combat corpsman for a platoon that was mainly, the main mission was to go outside the wire and perform, you know, security details and so on and so forth. So when I was in Iraq, I had the, I would say, opportunity to experience that as a female who was doing missions outside the wire. And outside the wire, I mean outside the green zone, you know, like the comfort of a huge military base.
So what was that like, first time finding yourselves out on a patrol and you're with this unit that's doing these security checks? What was that? I imagine there's a certain amount of, you know, a little bit of sort of trepidatious kind of feeling about it, but also you've been training for it, right?
So, yes, we did train a lot for it. When I first got there, honestly, my true thought was, wow, I wish my mom could see this.
Yeah.
You know? But when you first go out on your first mission, there is so much adrenaline going through your body. You know, you have all these expectations of what you've been trained for. So you're thinking of the worst possible situation. You know, you want to be prepared for that. And even there's an anxiety that goes through you. There's a stress that, you know, that is building up inside you.
Mm-hmm.
But some way, somehow, you make it through, you know. And so that first mission, you get it over with, and you're kind of like, phew,
yeah.
Thank goodness.
And how would you say your experience, you know, we were talking earlier with Erica Borgren about her experience as a woman in the culture of the military. And she had noted that she'd been out of the service for 5 years now, and so she wasn't necessarily speaking to the current culture. You just got out of the service a couple of years ago, right?
Yes.
What would you say was your experience as someone who was in the military more recently? As a woman, how were you treated?
Well, fortunately, I never dealt with sexual harassment, and that was because I happened to be with a great group of Marines. Unfortunately, though, I did have to deal with some sexism within my own platoon when I was over in Iraq. It was, this security platoon was made up of a lot of, we call them grunts,
mm-hmm.
you know, so more infantry type of MOSs. And, well, in those grunt units, there aren't a lot of females. So being a female military person, you're kind of looked down on as the weaker, kind of unnecessary person. So I actually do have an unfortunate experience I had to deal with that. And it was pretty hard. And I mean, I got through it, you know, tough skin and so on and so forth. But it was unfortunate. I had been in Iraq. We were back in our base, and we were, I guess, I was an E5, which is kind of on a higher rank than some of the other people in my platoon.
Mm-hmm.
But as a medical person, as a Navy person, I felt that my rank deserved to be respected, you know, as well as all the other Marine Sergeant ranks, which is the same, E5. So, but in my platoon, we had two different rooms. One room was for the E4 and below, and the other room was for the E5 and above. And I was actually excluded one day. It was just because I was a female. And they told me, one sergeant told me, like, hey, doc, you, that's what they called me. Mm-hmm. Hey, doc, you're going to have to leave because we need to talk about, you know, important, you know, confidential stuff. And so I don't remember what it was, but I was like, okay, come on, guys, seriously, stop. It's cold outside, you know. And then the actual master sergeant and, like, the head of the guy who was in charge of us, he was like, no, doc, leave. You know, and when he says it, of course, I have to do it.
Right.
You know, he's the boss, basically. And when I left the room, I was kind of upset about it, but it was just them trying to get me out, because I can hear through the other side of the door, like, you know, their comments or whatever, laughing and joking around. So I was pretty upset by that. I was out in the cold, and me being as prideful as I am or as stubborn as I am, I wasn't going to go into the E4 and below room.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to demean myself. I'm not going to bring myself down to a lower level, because I personally didn't feel like I should have been.
Right.
You know, I hold myself to a standard that should have been respected through across the board, you know. So,
Dr. Osborne, let me bring you in at this point. Before we get into the transition out of the military world and into the civilian world, I'm just curious, you deal with a lot of veterans who come back from tours of duty, and do you hear these kinds of scenarios, these kinds of situations?
You know, it's very difficult to really sort of paint a picture of what a veteran's experience is, because I think that there's so many different dynamics that are in play. There's the individual experience, and then there's the larger experience, and a large part of that, I think, is related to the leadership of the units in which they're transitioning.
I do
quite a bit, though, deal with this difference of culture, and I think that that's, in my experience, probably the most fundamental piece of looking at readjustment issues and making that transition. We have to navigate through the complexity of culture, and the military culture, for example, is very different than the university culture. And since 9/11, we have less than 0.5% of Americans who have served in the military, so there's a mystique that goes with the military. So it's a very complex piece, and I get that a lot. I get these, you know, very large blanketed questions from people who say, you know, what's going on with veterans? And it's sort of like, well, you know, do you have 6 hours to sit down and talk about it? So.
Elizabeth, how has the transition been from leaving military life, returning to civilian life, and ultimately as well going to school at the University of Illinois?
Well, leaving initially was pretty scary, because you're leaving your financial security, you're leaving what you know. I've been doing it since I got out of high school, so basically I was raised in the military so far. And whenever you decide to get out, you are faced with these big time, you know, on your own decisions. So leaving, I was lucky. I went straight from my base to Champaign. I'd never been to Champaign before, and I decided to come straight to school. I was also fortunate that my brother, who is also a military veteran, he lives here and he goes to school here, so I was able to get a lot of guidance from him. When I first got here to the University of Illinois, I had met another student veteran who welcomed me into the RSO that the university has, the Illini Veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get a lot of guidance and resources through the Illini Veterans. You know, so my transition was probably a little bit easier than somebody who could be, you know, a little bit more reserved or closed off or not really social, I guess.
Did it help to go straight from essentially the experience of military bases to a college campus where at least, you know, locations are pretty clearly identified and structured and that sort of thing? Or was it still a bit of a, you know, a different culture and impact kind of for you?
Well, it was a different culture. There was definitely an impact. But it's funny that you say that. I felt that when I first got on campus, a comfort because everything was so close together within walking distance, just how it would be on a base. Everything, there were clinics, there was food court, there was, you know, a little shopping center. And we had that sort of thing at the on bases, usually. So everything you need in one spot.
But people don't necessarily march in a line.
No, they don't.
On campus.
They do march, though. They march from class to class. Right. It's definitely not in a line. And the student culture is a lot different than the military culture. That was a hard transition for me.
Well, in particular, I imagine, I mean, you're in your mid-20s and you're dealing primarily with students who are in their late teens, early 20s.
Yes.
What's that? It's the world we live in when we're still teenagers and the world we live in as adults in, you know, once we get into our mid-20s. It's a very different world.
Oh, goodness. Yes, it was. It was frustrating beyond belief. You know, I'm coming from a situation where I have my own household goods and everything. You know, I feel like I'm an adult. Then I get to a classroom. I sit down. I'm thinking, okay, I'm here for a purpose. I'm here. This is my job, is to learn, is to listen to this professor in front of me. And it's really frustrating and distracting when, you know, the student culture, it's almost like they don't care that much. You know, they don't care to really pay attention. And for a person who... my alert level is all over the place. So I'm really trying to focus on this professor, and I've got, you know, Joe Fraternity or Susie Sorority sitting behind me, like Facebook surfing and talking about, you know, their weekend activities and so on and so forth. It was very frustrating. I had to, and in the military, we have this habit, or at least in the Marine Corps, if there's a problem, you confront it. You know, you're disciplined. You make sure that there's order. And so this urge to want to turn around and set them in their place the way that we usually do with our military peers was very difficult. I had to really hold myself in.
Dr. Osborne, what are some of the major challenges that face military veterans when they leave the service and reenter civilian life?
I think that's a great question. And Liz touched on quite a few of them. One piece is that I think that there's this change of identity in the sense of mission and purpose, that when you're in the military, I think regardless of whether you're serving in combat or just serving during peacetime, that there's a clear sense of mission and that you're entrusted with a lot of responsibility. And that can be making life or death situations. It can be maintaining expensive high-tech equipment, interacting with foreign governments and things like that. And so there's a maturity process that I think that happens very early for a lot of service members. And when they make that transition out of the military, they're contending with sort of, what is my new mission and my new purpose now? Where's my camaraderie? Where's my social support network? Where's my sense of community? And then when they make the transition into higher education, being non-traditional learners, being older, more likely to commute to campus, they're not necessarily feeling as connected to the larger university where our traditional students may feel connected. And then there's also what Liz touched on in terms of just the culture that we're familiar with in the military. And, you know, seeing people who we might quote-unquote judge to be as undisciplined or being disrespectful just simply by, you know, cruising the internet during a class period or coming in late. So I think that there's a lot of those factors that are there. And then the other part is, when they reveal that they are a veteran, some students have articulated that there's a fear that they're going to be unfairly judged or just misunderstood, because there's so much right now in the larger media about post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury and this image of sort of a violent or possibly unstable veteran. So there is also a reluctance to really share and to go forward with, you know, I'm a military veteran and I served in Iraq or Afghanistan.
We have a couple of folks on the line. Let's take some calls. Doug is in Thomasboro. Good morning, Doug.
Yeah, hi. This is Doug Rocky. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, Nick and I have talked a lot and everything. Nick, you're doing a good job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I mean, one of the big problems we still have, we've got, you know, well over a million from Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom are seeking medical care. So the medical health effects of the war from Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, going back to Desert Storm, going all the way back to Vietnam are staggering, and that affects everybody. The other big transition, just trying to get that medical care, is a nightmare. So how do you function in the academic environment where you have physiological problems that interfere with learning? So that's a big problem where, you know, resources have to be there, and I know Nick's working on that. The other big problem we have, and not so much here, I've been a professor at other universities at the U of I forever, coming in and out of the military. The students we get to the U of I, and this goes back to the Vietnam era when I first got to the U of I, are the best, the cream of the crop that you're ever going to see in the military. Yesterday I was in the student veteran lounge, and the ones I all met were former Navy nukes. I mean, this is the best of the best in the entire military that are students at the U of I now. So it's a whole different cohort group. So when the transition comes down, the academic prerequisites we need for employment in the veterans is a big problem. The majority of the veterans don't have the high school preparation, much less going to a junior college, much less a U of I.
Doug, I'm going to stop you there only because we're starting to run a little short on time, but I want to give Dr. Osborne a chance to respond. And one of the things I'd like you to sort of focus on is something I talked about with Erica Borgren, which is this idea of does there need to be more effort towards bridging the gap between what veterans learn within the military and matching that up with what education may be left for them to learn through universities like the U of I versus having to start over in some cases because there isn't an understanding of, oh, they've actually received this training.
Yeah, I think that that's a fundamental piece. And, Bill, it's good to hear your voice, by the way. I think that Erica Borgren is doing a fantastic job in really trying to create a rubric because we have so many qualified student veterans who are here who are doing some amazing things and who attended schools and developed a lot of education. But unfortunately, that doesn't always translate into academic credit that they can use. And I think that moving forward, veterans are oftentimes looking at how they can articulate what they've done in the military into more of a civilian framework. And higher ed is going to have, I think, a larger responsibility in that area. We fortunately here have a great career center on campus, and we're doing career fairs specifically for employers looking to hire veterans, but also we're helping our students articulate what they've done in the military and how that can, you know, even being a quote-unquote grunt or infantryman, how that you can take the language and take your experience and really show that this is such a wonderful asset that can be used in so many other spheres.
We're, again, pretty short on time, but we'll quickly go to Susan in Urbana. Hi, Susan.
Hi, I wanted to share two book titles. One, I saw the author on Bill Moyers and Company, so people can see this extended discussion with the author, Carl Marlantes. They can see it online. The book is What It Is Like to Go to War. He's a Vietnam veteran, and it's quite amazing the kinds of things he talks about, and he feels strongly that soldiers need more psychological preparation and care during their tours and before and after. And then I'm in a book group, and we're going to be reading, and I haven't started it yet, Band of Sisters, American Women at War in Iraq. I understand it's quite good, and so I'm offering that as a suggestion. And I see on Amazon that there's quite a few other books about women and war.
Right.
So anyway, suggestions for further reading. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the call.
That's a great book. Yeah, Kirsten Holmstedt was actually on campus last year, who's the author of Band of Sisters, and she did a wonderful presentation. It's a great, very insightful book.
I'm afraid we are just out of time, but I want to say thank you to our guests, Dr. Nicholas Osborne, Assistant Dean of Students for Veteran Student Support Services at the U of I. He is himself a veteran of the U.S. Coast Guard. Dr. Osborne, thanks for joining us. Thank you as well for your
pleasure.
Service. And Elizabeth Ambrose is a veteran Navy corpsman, now student at the University of Illinois. And you said you're preparing to take your MCAT soon, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking with us, and thank you for your service as well.
It was my pleasure.
That wraps up this encore edition of Focus for Memorial Day, a program that first aired on January 31st, 2013. I'm Jim Meadows, and tomorrow on the show, we'll be back live to talk about Uncle Joe Cannon, Republican Speaker of the House in the early 20th century. He was one of the nation's most powerful House speakers and one of the most notorious, according to his critics, and he had a few. Congressman Joe Cannon represented East Central Illinois, and tomorrow we'll talk about his colorful political career and his influence on the area, including Danville and Tuscola. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. Our technical director is Jason Croft. We always welcome your questions and comments about the show. Visit us online at will.illinois.edu/focus. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Happy Memorial Day. I'm Jim Meadows. Thanks for joining us.
It's hard to be in two places at once, but our reporters are in hundreds of places right now.
For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in Accra.
I'm Matthew Bell in the Golan Heights.
I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you a global perspective on the news with a worldwide network of correspondents.
In Paris.
Morocco.
Cairo.
In Mexico City.
Join us here at The World.
Monday through Friday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 a.m. and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
From W.